From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we have Congressman Derek Kilmer. Our listeners may wonder why this podcast is about transitions, after all. Well, here's why. As we've learned from the podcasts covering the Carter to the Trump transitions, the way that transition teams and new presidents engage with Congress is critically important for the success of every president. So my colleague Christine Simmons, who's Vice President of Government Relations at the Partnership, suggested Congressman Kilmer as a wonderful guest. He represents the state of Washington's 6th Congressional District and has been chair of the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. The Select Committee is one of the few truly bipartisan committees in Congress, with an equal number of Republican and Democratic members. Under Chairman Kilmer's leadership, the committee has produced more than 100 bipartisan recommendations on how to improve Congress, several of which involve the best ways to support and prepare new members of Congress, their transitions. So, Congressman, thanks for being here. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Happy to be with you.
So I love to start with these podcasts with people's backgrounds. And it's particularly interesting for me with your role in Congress, because the way one approaches their job in Congress reflects both their background, their upbringing, and also their district. So you grew up, you had two parents who were school teachers, and you came from kind of a blue collar area in Western Washington. So tell us a little about where you grew up and your upbringing.
Yeah, I grew up in Port Angeles, Washington, which is historically has been a timber town. It was a great place to grow up. As you mentioned, my folks were school teachers, but I was in high school right around the time the timber industry really took it on the chin and saw a lot of my friends' parents lose their jobs and a lot of my neighbors lose their jobs. And it had a big impact on me. And, you know, it sort of altered the trajectory of my adult life. I went off to college and studied public policy, and my senior thesis was literally focused on helping timber towns back home and trying to get an understanding of, from a policy perspective, how do we have a more sustainable economy and a more sustainable community? And then did the same thing in graduate school and then came back home. I worked in business for a few years, mostly to try to get out of student debt, unsuccessfully, I should add. And then I went to work in economic development. I was working for a nonprofit that was focused on trying to bring more jobs into our region and trying to keep the jobs we have. And I kept finding myself saying, gosh, you know, government has a big role to play for good and for bad in determining our capacity to grow jobs. And, you know, at some point, some of my friends said, you seem to have a lot of good ideas and you sure complain a lot. Why don't you go do something about it, pal? And the next thing I knew, I was running for the state legislature and worked primarily on economic development policy.
So you wrote your thesis in undergrad on the timber industry and the decline, which, you know, decimated parts of the Northwest. I know quite a bit about it, not as much as you. And then in grad school, you were a Marshall Scholar. For people that don't know, I have a friend who's a Marshall Scholar, and he always explained to me that that's a Rhodes Scholarship for smart people. And you wrote your thesis there on the decline of the coal industry in certain parts of the UK. So what were your conclusions about what the government can do when you have a singular industry that is so important for a community that is no longer viable?
Yeah, I looked at the, in graduate school, I looked at the similarities between the coalfield communities in the UK and timber towns in the Pacific Northwest, and really trying to get a handle on what can we learn from each other. And I wish I could tell you there was a silver bullet to helping communities navigate economic change. I don't think that's true. I think it's more like silver buckshot. There's a whole bunch of stuff you've got to do, you know, from an infrastructure standpoint. And these continue to be challenges. You know, much of the infrastructure on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State was oriented towards the timber industry. And as we've tried to, you know, and the timber industry has been and will continue to be an important leg of our economic stool. But as we've worked to diversify the economy, it is a problem that we don't have adequate access to broadband. You know, that was not a problem that all of a sudden popped up during a global pandemic. You know, certainly this pandemic has highlighted the fact that access to the internet is not just about whether you can watch the Borat sequel on Prime. It, you know, can't can your kid keep learning if school gets canceled, and can your small business operate when its storefront gets shut down? And, you know, for a whole lot of my constituents, the answer to that is no. And so infrastructure investment is really a key piece of the puzzle. The work that we do to invest in education and provide access to skills is a really important piece as well. Providing some of that transition assistance as we work to diversify economies is really important. And I look at part of the role of government is to empower people to navigate economic change so that they're not victimized by it. And when I got into Congress, really our, you know, my goal, you know, we for our office wrote a strategic plan, and the number one goal for my office is just creating more economic opportunity for more people in more places. And number two is trying to make government work better. And, you know, as you mentioned, the work of this committee on modernizing Congress has been part and parcel of those efforts.
So I want to get to the committee's work, because it's truly one of the real bipartisan efforts, and that's consistent with everything we do at the partnership. But before I do that, let's just go into the context for this Congress. So in the last Congress, there were 233 Democrats. There's still, I think, four outstanding seats that have not been called, although one is in Louisiana, and I think two Republicans are in a runoff, so that will go Republican. But, you know, there'll probably be 222, 223 Democratic seats. Cedric Richmond left to go in the administration, so that's minus one, at least for a period. So Speaker Pelosi will have a very, very small majority. You need 218 votes to pass anything, and looks like you'll have 222 or 223. So what does that mean for how this Congress will operate from a bipartisan perspective compared to previous Congresses or previous House operations?
Well, I think it's a little bit difficult to say right now, particularly since the Senate hasn't been decided yet. But I think, and I certainly hope, that it will lead to more bipartisan cooperation. I represent a district that needs government to work well. And that means we need to get some pucks into the net to help people, whether we're talking about rebuilding our economy or expanding access to healthcare or crushing this virus. My constituents actually need government to work. And, you know, that means legislation has to pass the House, pass the Senate, and get signed by the president. And I think certainly as we look to address some of these challenges facing our country, the fact that we have these tight margins in both the House and in the Senate suggests that regardless of how the Georgia runoffs go, we're going to have to find common ground where we can.
So let's talk about the Select Committee on Modernization. What is it?
Yeah. So about every two or three decades or so, Congress realizes that things aren't working the way they ought to. You know, I'm conscious as someone who came into Congress that according to polling, Congress is less popular than head lice, colonoscopies, and the rock band Nickelback. And, you know, there is a sense that Congress is sort of punching below its weight. And so historically what happens is that every two or three decades, Congress creates some sort of committee to look at how to fix it. And we're the latest incarnation of that. We were established as part of the rules package in 2019 when the new Congress was established. And as you mentioned, it was set up intentionally, I think in part because if you're going to do systemic reform, it has to be bipartisan. So our committee was set up with six Democrats and six Republicans. We were given a pretty broad mandate. We were tasked with looking at things like House rules and procedures and technology and innovation and the recruitment and retention and diversity of staff and constituent communications. We also decided to look at things that weren't directly in our mandate, including some of the dysfunction around the budget and appropriations process, things like civility and continuity of government. But our committee members decided early on that we would have a North Star mission, and that mission is to make Congress work better for the American people. And that really was at the heart of all of the work that we did.
And what are some of the most important recommendations? You came up with around 100 recommendations. What would you say the most important ones?
Well, it's interesting. I feel like my answer to this is not dissimilar to my answer to what do you do for single industry communities that are struggling economically. There's not a one thing, right? I think Congress is not challenged because of one thing. And candidly, getting things on track probably requires more than one thing. But we made recommendations in a lot of the spaces I just mentioned. So for example, I think there was a real recognition that one of the most important components of having Congress work better is the staff who work here. You know, there is extraordinary turnover within the Congress. It is very difficult to recruit, retain, and have diverse staff. And so a number of recommendations we made were in the service of trying to address that. So why is that important? Well, it's important because what we discovered was in the absence of being able to recruit and retain qualified staff, what often happened was that the executive branch and lobbyists filled the void. And that does not serve the interests of the American people. So we made a number of recommendations in that regard. We made a number of recommendations focused on civility, and including, and I know your podcast is focused on transitions, including in the transition process. I mean, there was a real concern and knowledge that this place starts partisan from the very beginning. When a new member comes into Congress, I mean, we had a member day hearing and you had members testify to the fact that, you know, I went through freshman orientation and they literally had Democrats get on one bus and Republicans get on another bus. And, you know, you're immediately segregated by party. And that does not lend itself to bipartisan collaboration, which is so often important in this arena. And so we made some recommendations on that front. The budget and appropriations process is perhaps one of the most acute areas where the American public is conscious of the dysfunction, because you've seen it in recent years with government shutdowns and continuing resolutions. The fact that Congress has not passed appropriations bills on time, it hasn't passed one appropriations bill on time since 2012, that is an enormous problem. So we made a number of recommendations in that space. You know, I could go on. You know, we ended up making nearly 100 recommendations, and they were bipartisan, and they were all in the service of having Congress work better for the American people.
Let's talk about the budget appropriations process, because that is really important. And the power of the purse is one of Congress's most important authorities under Article 1. So why is it so important to have a normal appropriations and budget process as opposed to just continuing resolutions, which have funded the government for the last number of years?
Well, one, it is a waste of taxpayer money when you have the approach that you have. You know, so let me give you an example. The largest employer in the district I represent is the Navy. Puget Sound Naval Shipyard in particular is the largest employer. Every time Congress comes up on a deadline, the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard actually has to plan for a potential government shutdown. When there is a continuing resolution, as you saw this past September, where Congress in essence kicks the can to December, what that means is when an entity, including Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, contracts for services, rather than contracting for a year worth of that service, it contracts for whatever length of time that continuing resolution is. So, you know, think about in your own life when you buy the 1 year plan or you buy the 6 week plan, when do you pay a higher price and when do you pay a lower price? We pay a higher price because we're funding government 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, at a time, sometimes a few days at a time as Congress kicks the can. That is not efficient, and it makes it very difficult for the purposes of planning. And, you know, unfortunately, this has become commonplace. I would also add, you know, and for those who are sort of constitutionalists, you know, what you've seen is a whole bunch of power move from the legislative branch to the executive branch, including the power of the purse. I mean, you have now federal agencies making spending decisions impacting my community and communities around the country without as much input from members of Congress. So we made recommendations in that regard too, not to restore an old earmark process that had abuse and was not as transparent as it ought to be, but to set up a new system that we called community-focused grant program, one that would enable congressionally directed spending in local communities, but in a way that was transparent that would prevent abuse and that would have, consistent with the views of the founders, members of Congress making decisions about spending, specifically with regard to decisions impacting their own district, rather than folks who are maybe well-intentioned but are sitting in marble buildings 3,000 miles away from my district.
And what about the issue of civility? So, you know, when I was in the Clinton administration, I worked on trade, in fact, with your predecessor, Norm Dix. And, you know, we worked as much with Republicans as Democrats on the trade agenda. What were your recommendations in terms of improving civility, improving relationships between Republicans and Democrats? And basically, you know, maybe this is the anti-modernization initiative of the Select Committee on Modernization, but getting Congress to do a little of what it used to do, which is Democrats and Republicans would fight during the day, but then go to dinner and spend time with their families at night.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And, you know, the lack of civility is not just evidenced by Twitter wars and, you know, clips that you see of people yelling at each other on cable news. But again, that incivility sort of feeds into this dynamic that leads to government shutdowns and other challenges. And so our committee identified that problem, even when it wasn't something that we were initially tasked with looking at. And so we did make some recommendations in this space. One, promoting civility during new member orientation, having new member orientation done in a nonpartisan way, but even having, and I just participated in this, having one of the sort of programs during orientation focus on collaboration and promoting civility. So we just had two Democrats and two Republicans speak to the incoming freshman class about that topic. There are other things that I think are important in that regard, specifically with relation to how committees function. And frankly, our committee adopted a whole bunch of the recommendations that we suggested other committees adopt with an eye towards having more civility and more productivity.
So one of your other recommendations actually mirrors the Presidential Transition Act in with respect to emergency preparedness exercises. So the Transition Act requires that the outgoing administration do a tabletop exercise for the incoming. So Bush for Obama did one on terrorism. Obama for Trump did one appropriately on pandemic prevention. And so you recommended a similar emergency tabletop or emergency preparedness exercise for Congress. How would that actually work?
Yeah. So the bottom line is we think it's actually pretty important for Congress to adopt procedures in advance of emergencies rather than in response to emergencies. And you know, interestingly enough, at the beginning of this year, before the pandemic hit, we were actually planning a hearing. We had a hearing planned on continuity of government, and we ended up having to pull it down because of real-time discussions that were suddenly taking place surrounding COVID. Once we were working remotely, we sort of shifted gears. We had some virtual committee discussions on different aspects of continuity. And out of those discussions, we developed a set of continuity recommendations. Some of them are stuff that you'd find yourself going, look, well, that makes sense even not during a pandemic. You know, we recommended that the House update its procedures to allow members to electronically add or remove their names as bill co-sponsors. In the year 2020 and heading into 2021, it doesn't make sense that, you know, there has to be this sort of hard copy paper process of you know, sticking something into the hopper, you know, and being there in person on the House floor. You know, to quote the beginning of the $6 million man, we have the technology. So there, you know, we made that recommendation prior to the pandemic. We recommended the expanding the use of digital signatures, things like this. And what we've suggested is, you know, and the House, to its credit, implemented those procedures because of the pandemic. We've recommended that they be permanently authorized. But we also had recommended that committees establish telework policies and that member offices have continuity and telework plans in place, and that members of Congress get cybersecurity, telework, and emergency preparedness training. And that is with the recognition that, one, with regard to cybersecurity, members are high value targets, congressional offices are high value targets, and that there are persistent cyber attacks on the legislative branch, and members need to be ready for that, and they need to be trained for being ready for that. Emergency preparedness, you know, you mentioned the incoming outgoing administration was trained on dealing with the pandemic. You know, Congress does not have much in the way of emergency preparedness training. And the concern is, from an Article I standpoint, you know, the executive branch is way more prepared for crisis operations than Congress is. And yet, our founders envisioned Congress as a co-equal branch of government, and it needs to figure out how to legislate in a crisis and how to function in a crisis, just like the executive branch does. And my expectation is this is something, you know, we made good progress on these issues, particularly over the 9 months of this pandemic. But I think the past 9 months have really made clear that Congress can and should do a lot more to prepare for the unexpected.
It's really important and well said. So let me just ask you a couple of practical questions. So are you in D.C. or are you in Washington State today?
Today I'm in D.C.
And so you've been flying back and forth between Washington State during the pandemic to vote and conduct your business in Washington?
I have.
And so, but doesn't requiring members of Congress to fly back and forth create unnecessary risk? And isn't that essentially the essence of your recommendation, which is in a national crisis, you should be able to do your work from wherever?
Well, I'd separate two parts of that conversation. The capacity for committees to work remotely is something that has generally been agreed to by both parties. The discussion around voting on the House floor has been, unfortunately, more partisan. There is now in the House rules the ability to vote by proxy. And you've seen a good number of members, either because of a medical condition or concern about the rising number of cases, or because they have someone at home who might be at high risk of COVID, you've seen a number of members vote by proxy. Unfortunately, that has not been universally embraced within Congress. And in fact, there's litigation by the minority right now challenging that ability to vote by proxy.
Well, what's the essential argument against having remote voting, proxy voting in an emergency?
I don't know. You'd have to ask one of my friends across the aisle who were part of that litigation.
Okay. I mean, this has been one thing we've been focused on at the center, which is a new president has to get 4,000 people in their seats. 1,250 of them need to be confirmed by the Senate. It takes a long time in good circumstances, in normal circumstances, to get those people in their seats. And we've been worried about the operations of the Senate during COVID and slowing down the process of getting people in their seats and confirmed as quickly as possible. And this goes back to something the 9/11 Commission report focused on after the delayed transition in Bush v. Gore, where Bush only had half as many people in their seats at the 100-day mark as Obama did 8 years later because of the shortened transition. And during the pandemic, during an economic crisis, it's essential that Biden get his people in those seats quickly. Let me ask you this. So you produced this really, you know, groundbreaking report in October. So what happens in terms of implementation and who's responsible for making sure the sound recommendations get implemented?
So we decided to do things a little bit differently on this committee. And that is, one, we functioned in a truly bipartisan way. And I can talk more about some of the things we did if that's of interest. But two, we decided that we didn't want to just produce a report. We wanted to actually produce change in Congress, which meant that as we produced recommendations, and we decided also to make rolling recommendations, if we could find agreement, we voted on that agreement, and then we pushed those recommendations out. We then agreed to turn them into legislation. So we've actually not just turned our first 30 recommendations into legislation, the House has passed those. So they are in the process of being implemented. That makes us the first select committee in modern history to actually pass recommendations while the committee is still in existence. And so I mentioned, as an example, some of our recommendations related to the transition for incoming members of Congress. Those things are being implemented in real time. On top of that, so we have another about 60 or so recommendations that the committee has passed that we are now turning into legislation. And our intent is to make sure that every one of the recommendations we made gets acted on. And we're going to push, whether it be through House resolutions or through statutory changes, to make these recommendations happen.
Let me pick up on something you said in that last statement, which I think is really important, which is how a member of Congress transitions to their seat. So this is the essence of the 1963 Presidential Transition Act, which is to make the transition smoother, faster, better. It's been amended 5 times since 1963. And basically the goal is to help a new president-elect hit the ground running on January 20th, because there's only 75 or 78 days between the election and the inauguration. So Derek, when you came into Congress, what did you do for your transition, and what should Congress do to make those transitions better so that members of Congress can hit the ground running on January 3rd? It's even a shorter transition for members of Congress than the President of the United States.
Yeah, it's a great question. And a new member of Congress is really drinking out of the fire hose, because one, they have to sort of learn the job and get oriented to the job. You know, here's the House floor and how you vote. And, you know, here's how the committee process works and those sorts of things. Not to mention the fact they have to hire up both a DC office and a district staff. So that's a lot. You know, there is an orientation process, which is a lot like drinking out of the fire hose, where members have to, as quickly as possible, sort of learn the job. And as a consequence of that, actually, our committee made some recommendations focused on changing that a bit, so that orientation wasn't just a November, you know, an election day through January 3rd exercise, but that orientation continued so that you had more sort of just-in-time, real-time orientation. As an example, you may not need to know the intricacies of the appropriations process as a new member in November or December before you've been sworn in, but you probably need to know them as the appropriations process is kicking off in the spring. And so we recommended doing some of that just-in-time orientation, so you were learning the things you need when you need it most. I would also mention a couple other things. There are some outside resources that can be helpful. The Congressional Management Foundation puts out a book each Congress, I think, called Setting Course. And it's actually terrific. There are books like the Setting Course book that can be very informative to a member coming in. The other thing, and the other area where we made some recommendations to try to help incoming members of Congress, is historically they have not been allowed to have a paid staff person work with them through the orientation process. So that either means you're a solo act as an incoming member of Congress, going through all of this on your own, including having to find an office, find office space in your district, staff up a DC office and a district office, learn the ropes on your own, or you're asking someone to come with you and serve as a transition staffer that's not getting paid, or that might be getting paid out of a campaign. And for a lot of people coming in, they don't have any money left in their campaign. And so we made a recommendation that, just as the Senate does, that members have a paid transition staffer. And that has happened now with this incoming class. And we've talked to incoming members who've said, wow, that's really helpful. Thank you.
That's great. So I have one final question for you, which is, what do you know now that you wish you knew during your transition into Congress?
It's a great question. I wish I had a good answer to it. I've learned a lot about both when this place works, why it works, and sometimes I've learned why it doesn't. You see very obvious instances of dysfunction. And I think some of it is related to the ability to constructively engage members of Congress so that they are not destructively engaged. You know, the Kilmer family has a new puppy. We, like many families, got a pandemic puppy. Australian Shepherd Penny is adorable, but you know, I've discovered that if you don't constructively engage Penny, she chews the furniture. And that kind of happens in Congress too. When people don't feel invested and engaged, they chew the furniture, right? They engage in things that contribute to incivility and contribute to dysfunction. That really shaped how our committee functioned. You know, Tom Graves, who served as our vice chair, and I made some conscious decisions early on in this process, and that was to truly have a bipartisan committee. Our committee ended up recommending things to encourage more bipartisan collaboration and more productivity, but we modeled those things ourselves. So let me give you some examples. You know, when a committee is established in Congress, they get a budget. And what generally happens is the budget is split between the Democrats and the Republicans. Democrats use their part of the money to hire people with a Democratic background who put on blue jerseys. Republicans use their part to hire people with Republican backgrounds who put on red jerseys. And then they spend the rest of the time duking it out with one another. We consciously made a different decision. We said, let's have one nonpartisan staff, one budget, one office, no red jerseys or blue jerseys. Everybody's going to put on a fixed Congress jersey. And that was really constructive. You know, we hired our staff together, and some of them were people with Democratic backgrounds, some with Republican backgrounds. We held a bipartisan agenda setting retreat shortly after we were formed, and it really helped us establish a positive bipartisan approach to our work from the outset. That was really valuable. We worked as partners. Vice Chair Graves and I worked as partners. Our committee members worked as partners. So we would spin off a Democrat and Republican to work on technology reforms or on staffing reforms or on civility reforms. And that actually encouraged bipartisan collaboration. We would meet regularly in private as a full committee. And what that meant is we were allowed to have some honest conversations and sometimes some really tough debates about how do you reform the budget and appropriations process? What do you do to solve some of these problems? But having those discussions in private, one, doesn't happen enough in Congress, and two, can be really useful in terms of building trust between members. You know, we also experimented with some small but not insignificant things like mixed seating arrangements during our hearings. So rather than having Democrats sit on one side of the dais and Republicans sit on the other, we had Democrats and Republicans sit side by side. So why was that important? Well, what it meant was in the middle of a hearing, when you heard someone testify and say something interesting, you logically leaned over to the person next to you and said, gosh, what do you think of that? That was kind of interesting. And it just so happened that the person sitting next to you was from the other party. And that really helped encourage bipartisan dialogue and civility. None of that may sound like rocket science to you or to your listeners, but it's really unique in terms of how Congress functions or often doesn't function. And it means that both parties gave something up. As a member of the majority party, I gave up the right to just steamroll over the minority. But the minority gave something up too. And that is they gave up the ability to just sit on the sidelines and just vote no. You know, and they gave up the ability to chew on the furniture, right? They were invested in the outcome and engaged in the process. And I think that was a real lesson learned at the end of this process for me, and I hope is an instructive lesson for other committees too. If you want to be productive and have constructive engagement, there are some ways to do it.
Well, Derek Hilmer, I've been around for 30 years in Washington. I think I've heard everything about Congress, but I've never heard a Congress is a puppy analogy, so I thank you for that. Thank you for being here, sharing your wisdom, and most importantly, thank you for your service to our country.
You bet. My pleasure.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.